Is the bloom in DC as bad as it is down here? Have all the plants opened?
Yeah,
up?
But I don't have allergies.
I just don't have allergies.
No.
Well,
your entire life you've just never.
No.
Did you grow up on a farm where you got like to interact with plants from a very early age, or is there any secret behind it?
I grew up in Manhattan. I never met a plant until I actually moved out of DC.
I don't know why that makes me so angry.
Sorry.
I've been on like antihistamines for 30 years and you just get to walk through life just breathing free.
You know, for me, it's like having grown up in a rural area. It's a bit like these developing revolutionary countries who are saying, okay, yeah, you know, we're behind, but at least we still have the strength. We at least can still enjoy nature without an allergy. And then to see something in reverse, someone growing up in Manhattan and, yeah, not having that, I think it just destroys our self-image.
That's a nice segue into the topic, by the way. It's very well done.
Everything is segued.
Can you introduce yourself and tell me what we're here to talk about today?
So my name is Fabian Hinz. I'm a research fellow at the IISS here in the Berlin office. And I've spent a lot of time studying the Houthis' drone, ballistic, and cruise missile programs using open sources.
So we've wanted to talk about the Houthis for a long time. I had trouble kind of tracking down... tracking down someone that knew what they were talking about, but also wasn't completely off the rails a bit. So I really appreciate you coming to talk about this. Can you give us the quick and dirty history of the movement?
Yes. So when you look at Yemen, Yemen was a divided country for a very long time. You had northern and southern Yemen. And northern Yemen was ruled by an imamate until 1962. So you had direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad ruling as imams belonging to the Zaydi sect of Shia Islam over northern Yemen. And that ended in 1962 when you had a crew of Arab nationalists, you know, basically the political movement of the time, Arab nationalism infused with a bit of socialism, but not too much, supported by Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser back then. Then you had a short civil war of the imams, or the former imams, not willing to cede power and fighting back for a while, but still everything stabilized in a new form of republican governance after that. And these called Sayyids, these families who were direct descendants from the Prophet Muhammad, who used to hold an enormous amount of influence over society, apart from actually ruling the country, were now quite marginalized compared to before. And this really became an issue in the 1990s when you had a stronger influx of Saudi money, Saudi ideas as well, including more radical forms of Sunni Islam. In response to that, you had some sort of Zaydi revivalist movement. So going back to Zaydi Islam and doing basically Zaydi identity politics. That's when an organization called the Believing Youth was founded, which was basically a Zaydi identity politics movement led by the Houthi family. And that movement then quickly turned into a political movement. And then it entered the fray of Yemeni politics, which, as we all know, can get a little bit wild sometimes. So then you had this very, very Yemeni thing of a playing field where you don't have real enemies and you don't really have friends. It's all based on alliances and enmities that can shift really quickly. Basically, what happened is that the Houthis fell out with the government. They then had a total of 6 rounds of war with the central government and the former president Ali Abdullah Saleh. And then, of course, Saleh was overthrown in the Arab Spring. And the Houthis basically used that kind of power vacuum to ally with their former rival Ali Abdullah Saleh to take over power in Sana'a and take over large parts of Yemen in 2014-15. And then trying to expand to rule the whole country, which was stopped by international intervention led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, that fought the Houthis for quite a while until you had a ceasefire. And that is basically how we arrived at the situation today.
What do the Houthis believe in? I mean, do they have an ideology that's driving them?
You know, that is a bit difficult to answer because they do have an ideology. They are very ideological, but at the same time, it's not that coherent. They have central concepts like the Quranic march, but it's not entirely clear what it's about. It's it's about the value of the Quran in Islam. That's okay. That's something, but what does it mean in practice? They have the teachings of Badreddin al-Houthi, the father of the current leader of the movement, Abdel Malik al-Houthi. But then again, that isn't really a coherent ideology. It's like sermons given over over years and decades, some of which have been recorded in the 1990s and 1980s. So they try to build a very stitched together ideology out of that. But one can say that they do have a strong ideological basis in their opposition to the West, to Israel, and that opposition to the West and to Israel that very, very prominently features in their logo, which says death to America, death to Israel, et cetera, et cetera, has been a constant feature of the movement for a very, very long time. So I would say if there's a clear ideological basis, this is as clear as it gets.
So it's more about what they stand against and kind of this cult of personality around
and total control. Yes.
They don't call themselves the Houthis.
They
right?
call themselves Ansarullah, so basically the supporters of God.
Okay. What can you tell me about Houthi himself? Mm-hmm. This leader, like, what is he like? Do we have any idea what mm-hmm. he believes? Has anyone seen him lately?
So he's a bit of a murky or mysterious figure. We, of course, know the basic details. He's the son of the Zaydi scholar, Hossein al-Houthi. And the Houthis, as a political movement, were first led by the brother of Abdel Malik called Hossein Badreddin al-Houthi. He got killed during the war against the Yemeni government, and now you have Abdel Malik in power. He does try to style himself after Lebanese Hezbollah leader Nasrallah in his speeches quite a bit. So I do think he's taking inspiration from Nasrallah in the way he brands himself, in the way he talks, in the way he presents his movement. But it's very, very difficult to know what type of character he is, what his closeness to regional actors like Iran actually looks like. It's just very difficult to know. It's not a transparent movement.
Yeah, because we're telling the story, our narrative, I mean, in the United States, seems to be that they're controlled by Iran, or Iran is really what it's all about. It sounds like that's not quite right.
You know, it's a very, very difficult question. So I'm studying missiles, rockets, and drones, and that is a very, very nice field because that's technology that you can compare. It's absolutely beautiful. You can exactly say, okay, this missile is from Iran. It's this type. We've seen hundreds of pictures. We know the exact configurations. But when it comes to ideology and decision-making, this is, of course, very, very different. I mean, it's this very old problem of intelligence and capabilities being easier to acquire than intelligence on decision-making and intentions. And I would say the same holds true for the Houthis because everything is so opaque. A lot of people read their own biases, I would say, into the Houthi-Iran relationship, often with very, very little evidence. And a lot of times we just don't know how big the influence is and how decision-making within the Houthis actually works.
But we know that they're getting a lot of equipment from Iran,
yes.
Right?
Yes, they do. There are different narratives. So basically one narrative is saying that the Houthis from the very beginning had this strong Iranian relationship, and there is some evidence to support it. Some members of the Houthi family spend quite a bit of time studying in Iran, living in Iran. Others are saying that these connections existed, but Iran, they were not really a proxy of Iran in the same way that Hezbollah was, and that Iran only started supporting them more and more after they started fighting Saudi Arabia because it was a cheap way of weakening a regional rival. Which one of these is true is very, very difficult to assess. I mean, one thing that is notable is that the ideology is quite different from, let's say, Hezbollah, which is 12-ish Shia. So basically the same sect of Islam that rules the Islamic Republic. It's a quite different ideology, which of course limits the ideological... Oh, sorry, let's say that again. It's a quite different ideology, But at the same time, you have these personal connections. But we just don't know how decision making looks like. So would decisions about, for example, the Red Sea attacks, would that be something that the Houthis do and the Iranians are okay with it? Is it some decision that's made collaboratively? Is it some decision that's made in some sort of joint operations room where one side is more leveraged than the other? That's something we don't know, but we know quite a bit about the weapons. So Iran really started supporting, giving major material support to the Houthis after they started fighting the Saudi-led coalition. There seems to have been some support before, but not nearly the same quantities and the same types of weapons. Iran has basically supplied small arms, anti-tank guided missiles, RPGs, these slightly, what was it? Iran has provided small arms, ammunition, RPGs, ATGMs. But it has also provided much more strategic weapons, including ballistic missiles, anti-ship missiles of various categories, as well as surface-to-air missiles. So we've seen a quite dramatic escalation of Iranian material support for the Houthis in the last 10 years, I would say.
So it's going back 10 years. It's not just in the last few months.
Yes, it has been going back for a while. And if you look at missiles, for example, it has been quite interesting because the Houthis had a missile capability, not really their own missile capability, but a missile capability allied to their movement, basically from the moment they took over Yemen. So Yemen, before the civil war, had a ballistic missile and anti-ship missile fleet, using Soviet missiles, North Korean missiles, Chinese missiles. And these forces remained loyal to the old president. And as I mentioned before, the old president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, allied himself with the Houthis. And so these units basically became part of the larger Houthi-Saleh alliance. And the Houthis started using them in their war against the Saudi-led coalition pretty early on, while they were still being controlled by Saleh. Now, that was a pretty small arsenal, and it was... The Houthis made pretty good use of it, but it was still limited in numbers, limited in range, limited in precision. And then you started to have missiles being used by the Houthis that were much longer range than anything the Yemenis had before the war. So suddenly they were able to hit Riyadh, about 900 kilometers away from the Houthi control of Yemen, with ballistic missiles. And in the beginning, Iran worked a lot on... tried very hard to maintain deniability. So these missiles would be somewhat similar to missiles the Yemeni army had before the Houthi takeover, or they would be systems that Iran had developed but had never shown to the public. And this way, they tried to maintain this veneer of deniability, but over the years, that has pretty much crumbled. And now they are openly acknowledging what they've given to the Houthis. And yeah, I would say in the beginning, it was limited, deniable systems in the field of missiles. And then it became gradually more in terms of range, precision, capabilities, et cetera, et cetera.
So does that mean Iranians are actually on the ground teaching them how to do this stuff or helping with the targeting? And I mean, it's fairly sophisticated, right?
Yes. So... the thing is, there are actually quite a bit of technological similarities between some of these Iranian systems that have been delivered and some of the systems the Yemenis used to operate before. So they had a, you could say, human basis for, you could say they already had experience operating similar systems before, and the Iranians could build on that. But then they also got entirely new types of weapons that the Yemenis didn't have any experience with. So I would presume that there have been Houthis being sent to Iran for training, and there are some reports about that, but also that the Iranians are on the ground in Yemen. So there are quite a few press reports saying that there are IRGC advisors on the ground training the Houthis. There are also quite a few reports saying that Lebanese Hezbollah is on the ground in even larger numbers. And if you look at the Iranian modus operandi, they often like to use Hezbollah as an intermediary because Hezbollah, they're Lebanese, they speak the language, they're culturally much closer to the Arabs than the Iranians. So it's quite useful to have them do the job.
So it sounds like you can track how happy Iran is with the Houthis by the equipment that's being used. Do we have any sense, since mm-hmm. these Red Sea attacks have started, has the equipment mm-hmm. changed in any way?
So we have seen one type of system that we hadn't seen before with the Houthis, unmanned underwater vehicles. This is a capability that Iran has been working on, and we hadn't seen it in Yemen before, and now there have been reports that the Houthis attempted to use them, but maybe they have had those before. Apart from that, I would say most of what we've seen being used was stuff that was already in the Houthi arsenal before. I mean, some of the systems might have been resupplied during the current crisis, but the basic types have been in service. The Houthis have alluded to new capabilities. There have been press reports about the Houthis testing a hypersonic weapon, whether that's accurate. Again, hypersonic is a very flexible term, so it might be a different capability that might be seen as hypersonic by the Iranians, but not necessarily by the West. So that's a different issue. But I would say the interesting thing here is not so much new systems popping up, but the fact that all of these systems were already in Houthi service long before October 7th. So after the ceasefire with Saudi took place in 2022 and held, the Houthis started staging large parades, having their first in 2022 and then having another one in 2023. And they paraded all of these anti-ship missiles. They paraded 12 different types of anti-ship missiles. They paraded naval mines, speedboats, and you could see that there was already an intent to equip the Houthis with a major naval capability. So, of course, how you use that naval capability and who takes the decision is a different issue altogether. But I would say this idea that the Houthis are sitting at a geostrategic choke point, and you can leverage that if you give them certain systems, that was already present before the Gaza war. And of course, whether that was the Houthis initiative and the Iranians being okay with it or the Iranians pushing for it, we don't know. But it's notable that it was there before the war.
It just seems like a nightmare that you have these almost independent actors. I mean, people who you wouldn't give these weapons to, one would think, right? I mean, it seems like such a strange strategic choice to give them these mm-hmm. weapons and, you know, hope that they do what you want them to do.
Many such cases in the Middle East.
Many such cases. Say,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, it is in a way a nightmare for the West, at least. I would say it's quite stunning if you think about how willing the Iranians were to supply some of their best capabilities to the Houthis. I mean, the Houthis have paraded a mock-up of one missile, whether it's actually in service or whether it's just a mock-up, it's a different question. I believe it's slightly more likely it's actually in service. The Khaybar Shekan, which the Houthis call a Hatem, and that is a precision-guided missile with a range of 1,300 kilometers and some capabilities to evade missile defenses, according to Iranian. That system was only unveiled in Iran proper in 2022. And then a few months later, we already saw it in Yemen. So the Iranians were really willing to give very long-range systems and very advanced systems to the Houthis, which is quite remarkable because if you look at some of their other exports, they're more reluctant. So we haven't really seen them do any commercial export of ballistic missiles. There are reports they might be doing that with the Russians right now, but apart from that, we haven't really seen it. But when it comes to their core regional geopolitical and ideological project, they're willing to break all the rules and transfer really impressive capabilities. The other thing that is interesting here is just how technology can change politics. I'm always saying, imagine it would be 1990 or 2000 and you had the Houthis. What could the Houthis do? The Houthis could fire artillery beyond the border for, let's say, 10 kilometers, 20 kilometers. They could use speedboats. Okay, they could do that to impede shipping. But then again, it's very easy to defend against a speedboat. Like commercial ships could do that themselves. They just get a few armed guards. They get perhaps a bit of foreign naval protection, and they basically have dealt with the problem. So I think it's really the fact that we now have the types of systems that can be used at standoff ranges to attack shipping, but also to attack other targets, critical infrastructure, military targets, that can be used if you don't have a large air force. That this is something which non-state actors and weaker states can use as the major force multiplier, especially if they have the right strategy, as I think the Houthis and the Iranians do.
What is that strategy?
The strategy is accepting that missiles are not the best tool for warfighting. If you actually want to defeat the Saudi military and you would try to do it using missiles, good luck with that. I mean, you're not going to destroy all Saudi air bases. You're not going to destroy all Saudi fighter jets. You're not going to destroy all Saudi tanks using a few cruise and ballistic missiles. If you have 100,000 of them, which no country on Earth has, it might work. Otherwise, it doesn't. We've seen Russia use a lot of missiles in Ukraine, but the effect is just not as impressive as the Russians probably would like. But if you're using these systems to target weak points of an adversary, and that could be critical infrastructure, thinking of the Aramco attacks in 2019. Again, we don't know. The Houthis claimed responsibility. We don't know whether it was actually launched by the Houthis, by the Iranians from Iran, by the Iranians from Iraq, or a combination of all of these. But you had a very limited amount of missiles and drones being able to wreck a piece of critical infrastructure, put out of operations for a few months, and then translate that into real geopolitical leverage. And the same applies to civilian shipping in the Red Sea. I'm always thinking if this was a purely military problem, the West would be doing great. I mean, you're destroying quite a few missiles, and the rest you can defend against them quite well. I mean, there's always a chance that one missile will get through, okay, but your navies won't get sunk. That's okay. You actually have a situation that's quite tolerable. But then you have civilian shipping companies, and they have a completely different appetite for risk, basically zero appetite for risk. And more importantly, you have the insurers, which have even less appetite for risk. So even if you have a capability that is incapable of defeating a major Western Navy or even a major Western Navy detachment to the Red Sea, it can still cause enormous disruption to civilian shipping.
How do they target ships they're firing at? I mean, do they have access to satellites or whatever? I mean, how do you? I actually don't know how missile systems work over, 1,000 miles. So.
I mean, here the thing really is that also times have changed in terms of technology, and geography is the Houthis' friend. So there's, of course, another country having a huge arsenal of anti-ship missiles, including anti-ship ballistic missiles, and that is China. And in that case, we were always talking about the Chinese kill chain. Do they actually have the satellites to track carriers, identify carriers in the open sea? But the Red Sea is just really, really small geographically. And then you have the Bab al-Mandab as a choke point, which is even narrower. And if that is your geography, you can use quite a lot of systems. You don't need satellites. So you can use UAVs. The Houthis have used quite a lot of UAVs for reconnaissance and for target identification. They do have the range. They don't need to be that complicated, that sophisticated. They can do that. They can use open source material. A lot of ships going through the Red Sea and the Bab al-Mandab still have their transponders on, and anyone can go to a website and see their approximate location. Sometimes they put messages there, hoping it will save them from Houthi attacks, saying, "Oh, it's all Chinese crew or no relation to Israel whatsoever." And they put that note on, which doesn't seem to be working either. And then, of course, you can just have a few people on speedboats or on fishing vessels who hand over coordinates, and that might not be the best and the most efficient way compared to having maritime patrol aircraft and satellites, but it does the job reasonably well enough. And then, of course, as another added bonus, they have the mysterious Iranian converted cargo ship, the Behzad, over there, which is widely suspected to be a forward operating base for the Revolutionary Guards.
It's kind of interesting that the things that happen in the ocean are so shady and strange. I don't think people understand just how lawless and weird the ocean can get. So you have all of these different ships that are claimed by three different countries and three different companies. But the fact is, the Houthis don't seem to give a shit, right? If you're passing through the territory, you are a target, period. It doesn't matter if you're saying that you're not involved. You're involved because you're part of international shipping. That makes you a target, full stop.
I mean, there are a few different ways of looking at this. Some people are saying, "Oh, the Houthis, Their ISR is not that good. Their target identification is not that good. They actually want to hit ships that are connected to Israel or now connected to America and the West after the airstrikes have started, but they're just not capable of doing that. But there's also the other view, which I think is probably more realistic, that the Houthis just don't care. They want to fire at everything that goes through in order to maximize the leverage. And I mean, to me, it's a bit like hijacking an aircraft. Like, it doesn't really matter whether the aircraft is connected to your political enemy. You just do it to basically make your problem everyone's problem and gain leverage through that. I think that's really the logic behind it. And to some extent, it
That's
works.
interesting. I think that's a good analogy. To like Arab nationalism was in the 70s and 80s was really big on plane hijackings. Houthis is really big. The Houthis are really big on disrupting international shipping. You've said a couple times that this is about political leverage for them. What is the political goal?
Again, this is very difficult to assess because we would have to know how the decision is taken, what role the Houthis play, what role the Iranians play. I would say there are several angles here. The first is the Houthis themselves domestically. They are very unpopular. The situation in Yemen is not that great for the Houthis. The economic situation is terrible. The Houthis as a governing force are not well liked. So they can jump on the bandwagon of the Palestinian cause and try to increase their popularity inside Yemen. That is one angle. The other angle is, I would say, I'm not sure whether this is actually their calculus, but I think it would make sense, is to say that the Israelis just don't care about these things. The Israelis have reached a stage where they see this as an existential war of some sorts, and some disruption to shipping will not actually change their mind on anything. But then again, you have the Western backers of Israel, and they're more sensitive to disruptions in global trade. And you can try to put pressure on them, hoping they will put pressure on Israel. That is another logic that I would think makes sense. And then yet another layer is the whole so-called axis of resistance. So Iran has really worked to establish or support existing armed groups all around the Middle East and give them long-range weaponry in order to have some sort of coalition of non-state actors capable of fighting Israel. And I would say that this has worked quite well in many ways, but also has its limitations, as we see right now. If the Israelis decide to start an all-out assault on Gaza, all these groups supported by Iran might have fantastic weapons, but it won't stop the Israelis from doing that. So to some extent, that approach has reached the limit of what it can do. But it still works to some extent. And within that axis of resistance, you have different elements having different capabilities and having different geographical positions. So each element can do something differently. So, for example, in Iraq, you have militias that are well positioned to needle the US presence there and exert direct pressure on the US to some extent. Of course, calibrating that can be quite difficult, as we've seen. And in Yemen, you have this movement being right to one of the major trade arteries of the world. So, of course, it's quite convenient for them to use that as a lever.
And it doesn't seem as if there's a whole lot that Operation Prosperity Guardian can really do about this. Like, as you were saying, missiles don't win a conflict. And we're in a situation now where we've just got a whole ass US carrier group just tied up in the Red Sea. Sure, we're shooting down drones and missiles, and it's cool that they're painting those on the sides of their Super Hornets, but like, so the only way you stop this really is it's the story as old as war, or the story as old as air power. Like, you have to go in there and get them out with people. And I don't think we've got the appetite for that.
I mean, it's quite true what you say. On a technological level, this is on an operational level, even, this is all very impressive. I mean, the defenses of Western ships have held really remarkably well. We haven't had a single Western warship being hit so far. I mean, it could always happen. Again, this is a question of statistics. How likely is it? How likely it is not to be hit? With the strikes, I would say one thing that has impressed me quite a bit is that there have been quite a lot of announcement by CENTCOM about hitting missiles just before launch, because hitting mobile missile launchers is something very, very difficult. Desert Storm, the Hunt for Scuds, it was not very successful, so the The fact that the US is apparently now capable of doing that to some extent is quite impressive if it turns out to be correct and it's not just decoys. But then again, so what? Does it change the overall strategic picture? And again, you have the you have civilian shipping companies that tolerate very, very little risk. And in order for them to feel safe again when passing through the Red Sea, you would need to destroy 99% of the Houthi arsenal, 100% of the Houthi arsenal. And of course, that's not going to happen. You're talking about systems that are road mobile in many, if not most cases, that are quite compact, that can be easily dispersed. The Houthis have quite some experience dispersing stuff after years of fighting the Saudi-led coalition, which of course was not as competent when it came to aerial warfare as the US, but still was a threat. So I think that's something they will not be able to achieve. And in terms of going in with boots on the ground, I think no one's really wanting to do that. No one has the appetite to do that. There are still factions inside Yemen who could be supported. That might be a way forward. But then again, do people want to do that? A few years ago, factions inside Yemen looked like they were marching on the port of Hodeidah. And back then, the West was actually very, very unhappy about this thought because it would have cut off the Yemeni population from the most important port, and Yemen is very, very dependent on the import of foodstuff. So there's always a chance that if you do something militarily in the area around Hodeidah, that could cause major disruptions to food entering the country.
I think it makes sense to just mention briefly. Well, first of all, that isn't that the port that everything goes through? I mean, or near to get through to the Suez Canal. So, just so people know what we're talking about. The other thing I wanted to mention is also that you mentioned the Saudis, and I don't know if people also know because the war was just not very much covered by the United, people in the United States or the media or whatever. But the Saudis did not succeed. I mean, they threw in a lot of money and a lot of bodies at Yemen and did not succeed over, I think it's a decade, right? I think that's what you said.
Basically, from 2015 until 2022,
Okay.
so
Yeah. So 8 years,
seven
I
years,
guess.
quite a long time.
Yeah.
The issue is in Yemen, no one really succeeds. I mean, when the Arab nationalist coup overthrew the imamate, there was a civil war. And quite ironically, the Zaidi supporters of the imamate, so the kind of social sphere that now of which the Houthis have emerged, was back then supported by Israel and Saudi Arabia because the biggest threat at that point was Arab nationalism. So you had this Yemeni civil war, and Egypt sent thousands of troops to support the government, and it became known as Egypt's Vietnam. So Yemen is not a place where you want to fight a war. The Saudis were not as incompetent as many people claimed. So they managed to do quite a bit, but at the same time, they were just incapable of dislodging the Houthis. Part of it is just the fact that the opposition inside Yemen, the opposition to the Houthis, is very, very fragmented. You have different factions with different agendas. Then you had, especially later on, disputes between the Saudis and the Emiratis, who were the biggest supporters of the anti-Houthi factions. And that, of course, makes it very, very difficult when you have a military that is often not capable of providing the type of close air support that you would need for a campaign to dislodge the Houthis, while also not having a reliable ally on the ground. That makes things very, very difficult.
So I also just want to mention to people like Yemen's not the most hospitable place in the world either. I mean, it's not rich. I mean, it's one of the poorest countries I think that there is. So I think, and there are a lot of places to hide, right?
Especially north, it is a very mountainous country. It's easy to hide. You have cave systems that the Houthis actually used in the wars against the government. There are underground facilities that are still being used for the missile force, and you have a culture of fighting. You have different tribes that also have, of course, are armed. So a lot of the Houthi fighting force might not even be Houthi fighters, but just tribes allied to the Houthis because of clever maneuvering and clever diplomacy within Yemen. So it is a place you really don't want to occupy.
One other question I had is just talking about weapon systems. Whenever you shoot down a missile, since lasers don't work yet, if they'll ever work, aren't you using another missile to do it?
So the first thing to notice that lasers already kind of work.
Do they really?
So
Oh, cool.
this is quite interesting. The Saudis actually imported a laser weapon system from the Chinese called Silent Hunter, and they operationally deployed it all around the country. You can see it on satellite pictures. Its radar looks very distinct on satellite pictures. And the Saudis recently revealed that they had used it, or claimed that they had used it, to shoot down a Houthi UAV a few years
Really?
ago. Yeah, so the Saudis might have been the first to use that laser in combat against the UAV. But then these systems have quite a lot of limitations still. So you have a very limited range. And of course, if you have adverse meteorological conditions like fog, rain, etc., it might impact the range even further. And then again, the laser has to stay on the target for quite a while, combined with the short range. That's not ideal. But they're operational. And I mean, this is actually something really interesting about the Yemen conflict, because it has been such a backwater conflict, but the amount of firsts we've seen in the Yemen conflict is quite stunning. If you think about it, so for example, long-range suicide drones, GPS guided, that was always seen as something weird the Iranians and the Houthis are doing. And we saw it a lot in Yemen. Now it's an everyday feature of the war in Ukraine. Explosive drone boats, we saw that with the Houthis years ago, was a very odd thing the Iranians and the Houthis were doing. Now we're seeing it in the Black Sea. Potentially the first use of a laser against the enemy UAV, that happened there. The first war combat in space, as many people have called it, the first exo-atmospheric interception of a ballistic missile happened not so long ago, when the Israelis shot down a Houthi ballistic missile being fired at Israel. And of course, the first use of an anti-ship ballistic missile. So there are a lot of firsts in this war. And when you shoot down missiles, it kind of depends on what type of missile it is. If it's a cruise missile, you can shoot it down with a gun as well. It's difficult, it works. But usually
They
used to
move a lot
intercept a missile.
slower and
Yes,
lower to
they
the
do.
ground. So, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So cruise missiles usually fly as low as possible. You would design them to fly as low as possible. Some of them, especially anti-ship cruise missiles, can go as far down as 5 meters in sea skimming mode, if it's a really advanced system. And usually cruise missiles are subsonic. There are supersonic cruise missiles as well. The Iranians supposedly are working on that one, but everything we've seen so far is subsonic. And ballistic missiles fly several times the speed of sound. So you would need an interceptor missile at this point in time to shoot them down. Of course, there are ideas about other types of defensive systems, but right now you would use interceptor missiles.
I am reminded of the conversation we had earlier this week, Jason, just a few days ago,
Exactly. Yeah.
we talked to Vera Bergengruen of Time about her piece, which is kind of about Western tech companies using Ukraine as a test bed for all sorts of different technologies. It sure sounds a lot like Iran has the perfect test place for all of its weapon systems in the Houthis in the Red Sea.
Oh, absolutely. And I actually do wonder whether, with some of these systems, the idea that you could gain combat experience was part of the rationale for transferring them.
Good times.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, exactly. I was wondering when you're talking about, I always wonder about this. Missiles cost a lot of money. And shooting down missiles costs a lot of
Yes.
money. So a conflict like this, it's a drain on everybody's resources,
Yeah.
right? I mean,
It is. The cost of that conflict is an interesting question in terms of systems, because a lot of times you have this narrative, oh, we're using a $2 million interceptor to shoot down a drone that costs $5,000.
right.
And I would personally argue, it's my opinion, that that is not quite the truth, because a lot of times, of course, these drones can be cheap, but sometimes these drones can also be more expensive. So if you talk about a slightly more sophisticated system like the Shahed, it becomes much more expensive. You're talking about probably $50,000, $60,000. And then, of course, you have anti-ship cruise missiles being used, which are substantially more expensive. Anti-ship ballistic missiles, we don't have any numbers from the Iranians, but I would suppose that they're also a lot more expensive. And then, of course, you have to put it into relation to the countries actually firing and sending these missiles. I mean, the US economy is substantially larger than the Iranian economy. So in the end, it might be a much higher burden for the Iranians than for the Americans to send an anti-ship cruise missile than to intercepting them. The other issue is, I think even if there would be an imbalance, I think it's less about money. It's more about stockpiles and supply chains and supplies. If you order new interceptor missiles, new SM-2s, for example, it will take quite a while until they arrive. You only have a limited stockpile. You have other global commitments for which you need these missiles for contingencies. So I think that's a much bigger issue than paying, I don't know, $50 million extra for a few more missiles.
Right. And I guess also you have to count the cost of the damage that would have been done.
Yeah, that's true.
So you spend $2 million, but you might very well have saved $5 million worth of damage.
That is true.
Forget about human lives, which are also, some people care about that.
Well, it's been a remarkably, at least on the. So they just killed, the Houthis just killed people, what, 2 weeks ago with one of these missile attacks for the first time?
Pretty recently was the first time they killed people. And I think one of the reasons these attacks haven't killed a lot of people, even the ones that hit successfully, was that these civilian ships are really, really large compared to warships. And they have very, very little crew on board. So the chances of hitting someone are just substantially lower than if you hit a US warship, for example.
And they're hard to sink.
They're hard to sink, yes. And especially when you use anti-ship missiles, you tend to hit them above the waterline, so the chances of them sinking are not zero. I mean, one ship has sunk, but it's less likely than when you use, for example, a torpedo.
Well, some of this is also about creating propaganda for them. It's not necessarily about sinking the ship. Sometimes it's about capturing it and turning it into a tourist
Yes.
attraction, right?
Yeah, they did that with the Galaxy Leader, and I think they've been quite successful because now there are so many Houthi memes on the anti-shipping campaigns and songs and everything, and it really strikes a chord, I think, with large parts of the Arab streets, as people sometimes call it. So I do think it has been a propaganda win for them. And that is also part of the reason why they do it, of course, internally, because they're not very popular in Yemen, but also to gain popularity outside their own country.
So, I've got kind of a couple stray questions here at the end that don't really fit anywhere else. Jason, do you have anything else?
No. This has actually been incredibly
This is great.
informative.
Yeah, this is a great
Yeah.
episode. Thank you.
I'm happy to.
Can we talk then also about kind of Western reactions to all of this? Because it has been kind of interesting. Because it seems like there has been a lot of people that are, celebrating this. They're kind of handing it to the Houthis. They're saying, if you can wait, 2 more weeks for your Amazon package, you really should. It's for a good cause. What do you make of this kind of groundswell of support for this movement?
I think there's a bit of a parallel in terms of Houthi support in the West and Houthi support in the Middle East, in the way that these are the newcomers. And the whole Israel-Palestine conflict has been so static with no real change in a way that people, partisans on all sides, are quite frustrated, I would say. And now you have the Houthis as this new force suddenly entering the fray. And at the same time, they're so removed from the conflict that you can actually joke about it. I mean, one thing I find absolutely fascinating about the Israel-Palestine conflict is how few memes there are compared to even Ukraine or other places. It almost feels as if the the war is so serious that people don't really want to joke about it. So at least my timeline on Twitter is much less about memes than when it comes to other conflicts. And I think with the Houthis, it's really a little more distance. So it's easier to celebrate them. And of course, the Houthis are a black box. There are very few people knowledgeable about them, so you can read into them whatever you want. And if you want to see a campaign that basically until recently didn't cause any casualties, that supports Palestine, then you could read that into it if you really wanted to. Of course, completely detached from the reality on the ground in Yemen and the Houthi ideology and behavior in other cases. If you want to see them as nothing else but a proxy of Iran, you can also see them that way because there's enough data points. So I think, in a way, because they're black box, they're also an area for projection in a way.
That's really interesting. I hadn't considered the fact that there's not really any internet culture kind of springing up from this Israel-Hamas war. So like the Ukraine war also very brutal, but I can pull up Telegram or VK and see all sorts of bizarre Russian memes, or I can watch, it seems like every day on Twitter, an FPV drone video of a Russian being blown up, and it's got the Benny Hill theme song over it, right? So like kind of human tragedy rendered into comedy. But with the Israel-Hamas war, nothing. I mean, definitely there is stuff cropping up in the Israeli space, but it is not going outside, and it is very much being tut-tutted by everyone. And then, of course, Gazans don't really have internet, right? So we're not really seeing how their culture is dealing with this conflict. That's a very interesting point.
Yeah. To me, it feels like everything is seen as so existential and emotions are running so high that you don't have the minimal level of ironic distance you need to make jokes about it. At least that's my impression. I could be wrong about
No,
it.
I think that's right. No, I think that's a very interesting observation. So the Because Ukraine and Russia is existential, but in a different way, and we have that distance. And to so many people, the lines are so clear, whether you're on whichever side of that conflict you're on, right? All right, well, I don't have any more questions, Jason, unless you've got something to see us out on.
No, like I said, no, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and taking us through this. I mean, I think I have a much better idea of what's going on with the conflict, and I'm quite
Yeah,
grateful,
really incredible
for
episode.
your
Thank you.
time.
Hope it was okay. As I said, I'm a little bit sick and on painkillers, so I have been completely incoherent. Please cut out everything you want to cut out.
No, you were great. You were
You
totally
were absolutely
coherent.
wonderful. This was exactly what I wanted to do. It's perfect.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Then next time I'm recording anything, I will take the painkillers again. Because I'm coherent because of the
Perfect.
pain. Great. Was a
Thank
pleasure.
you so much.